I will just take a second at the beginning of this homily to thank John for his invitation to come here this morning. It's both a pleasure. I see it as a great pleasure and a great responsibility to speak on this Sunday, which has been designated as National Indigenous Sunday. And I speak to you today in the name of the Creator, whose love knows no bounds. I speak to you in the name of Salana, the Liberator, who has offered us freedom from death in favor of abundant life. I speak to you in the name of the great and Holy Spirit, whose gifts are unity and reconciliation. I speak to you in the in-between times, the incomplete time, the time of longing for justice to roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. I speak to you today as a member of that Council of General Synod that added this Sunday to our church calendar. It's a day to acknowledge First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people, and to reflect on our relationships. It's a time to acknowledge past errors, celebrate positive moments in the present, and most importantly, to commit ourselves to journeying together toward a more generous future. Now, there are days when I feel quite optimistic about our voyage together, and days when I feel less hopeful. There have been apologies from church and national leaders, specifically about the impact of residential schools, but there have also been remarkable failures to accept responsibility for the past abuse, most notably this year by Pope Francis. And of course, just down the road, in this Parliament of Canada, we have an appointed Senator, Lynn Beah, who champions all the positive things that happen at residential schools. She ought to be a person of fewer words than she is. I am a person who has largely had positive relationships with institutions. I've been a priest for nearly 35 years. A military chaplain serving the government of Canada for nearly 24. I have a long and complicated understanding of my own place inside Indigenous communities. I also have a fundamental belief that institutions fail when their leadership places the needs of the institution above the needs of the very people for which the institution should be serving and caring. From a Christian perspective, we have to acknowledge that Jesus did not spend his time defending institutions. Jesus defended the poor, the marginalized, the vulnerable. Listen again to the words of the prophet Isaiah. God gives power to the faint and strengthens the powerless. Those who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. The church was a movement. I'm not sure it was ever meant to be an institution. It was meant to be the voice for the voiceless, the strength for the weak. So those who want to see Jesus will always find him standing up for those whose society is knocking down. Now, I want to speak to this in relationship to the Alapu experience in Western Newfoundland. In 1949, when Joe Smallwood led Newfoundland into Confederation with Canada, one of the terms of union was that anyone with Indigenous status would retain that status. This was really not a term that was pondered too long, as many believed that our Indigenous people, the Beothuk, had been extinct for nearly 100 years. There was a problem, though. On the west coast of the province where I grew up, there were people descended from Mi'kmaq people from Nova Scotia who had been in Newfoundland for nearly a century. And there are pockets of historical evidence. In the 1850s, the first Anglican bishop of Newfoundland visited the Bay of Islands. Bishop Field noted the presence of two Mi'kmaq women, one married to a Mr. Thomas Park in the village of Goose Arm. And then in the 1880s, and I think this is one of the saddest stories, in Breaks Cove, a small community that's been since resettled, a resident Ben Brake, in a fit of rage, killed a man with an axe. The St. John's papers explained away his uncharacteristically violent nature by referencing his indigenous heritage. He was known forever in the headlines as the Mi'kmaq axe killer. Locally, it was known if you were an Indian that the potential for a better job like the ones at the mill just was not available. So people denied that part of their heritage, now confirmed by science, by ancestry DNA, and in all sorts of other ways. Today, there is a revival of Mi'kmaq culture. Nearly 80,000 people have applied for their status, and if all were accepted, it would make the Halapu the largest band in Canada. Now, I was the only member of my family not to apply, and that's not well understood, even by members of my family. But my reasons, in a nutshell, were quite simply this. I decided that I would not allow the government of Canada or anybody else to decide who I was. And today, the registration process is in a mess. The arbitrary criteria that is being used is causing controversy and division in the small communities of Western Newfoundland. And how can it not? In the most bizarre case, in the town of Flat Bay, there are one-year-old twins, one considered eligible for First Nation status and the other not. The appeals and the lawsuits have begun. The institution protects itself, but it is hurting people. Still, in the midst of this rediscovery of Indigenous culture, I marvel at how it had almost completely disappeared. And I'm convinced some of the reasons for that were because its origins were with women. Genealogists tell us that women and their roots disappear from the family tree very easily. Perhaps that's why I was so enamored with the Haida people. They were matriarchal. Haidas belonged to two moieties, ravens and eagles, and 22 clans. And a person's clan is determined at birth, when they follow their mother. If their mother was a raven, they are a raven. And one of the implications of that is that a raven cannot marry another raven. They can only marry an eagle. So they can never marry inside their own moiety. I moved to Haida Gwaii, the land of the Hadalasis, the good people, just after I was married 25 years ago. My experiences there were life-altering. My whole theology changed. And the relationships that I built there were life-lasting. I was fascinated by their stewardship of the land and the sea, their art, their feast, their stories. I was also enthralled with their confidence as a people. No one will ever accuse a Haida of being cowering or having been conquered. They were the Vikings of the Northwest using their ocean wave-eating canoes to trade, raid, and to explore. There are old Haida stories of them having traveled to Japan. They are the consummate storytellers. And their confidence was ever thus. I love the story of the conversion of Chief Wiam, the raven chief of Massat. It's a St. Paul kind of story, with Wiam approaching Collison, who had been a missionary in Metlakatla among the Tsimshian people. What had just about destroyed the mighty Haida was smallpox. And when Collison came, it was for his medical knowledge. But of course, he told him about Jesus. When Wea heard about Jesus, he and most of his village were baptized. But his reaction to the story of Jesus was very interesting. First, he told Collison that the Haidas always knew about the God Collison preached, the God who is far off, who created us and loves us. They just didn't know that the Creator had sent his Son. Listen to what John says in the Gospel this morning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We know in the Greek, John uses the word logos, the living word. And of course, John uses this familiar Greek concept to teach Greeks about the nature of God and about Jesus. We already knew of the nature of God. And then we asked Collis another question, and I love this. He said, why did you Yatzaday, you people of the iron, you Europeans, give this important news to those Kelons, those Shimshan over there, instead of coming first to Haida Gwaii and to the Hadalasses? When I attended General Synod last year, one of the saddest things for me was the absence of the people of the Northwest Coast. No Shimshan, no Ida, no Gitsan, no Nisga, no prayers raised in their language, no button blankets. As a church, we are making progress, but there are entire nations being left behind, and we have to acknowledge as a church that the strength of our structures can sometimes be our weaknesses. And I'll tell you why I say that. You see, when a bishop in that diocese where the Haida lives believes that his role, his most important role, is to stop a marriage canon from being amended to include Anglicans who do not share his views, and so he appoints as his delegates a recently arrived conservative priest and his wife and his son as the delegates in a diocese where over 3/4 of the Anglicans are indigenous, then that's a very hurtful thing for the entire church. The theme for the General Synod in Montreal some years ago was Faisons notre voix, lift every voice. And the psalmist reminds us this morning, although we have no words or language, and their voices are not heard, their sound has gone out to all the lands, and their message to the ends of the earth. When Pierre Trudeau met for the first time around treaty settlement with the people of the Nass, he looked around the room and said to the Nisga leadership, everybody else brings their lawyers, but I see you have brought your priest. These were Anglican priests, and the relationship that we built with those people are sacred and needs to be restored. And I note that the Inuit people and the Métis are asking for the same sense of inclusion. There are wonderful opportunities ahead for us. And I'm pleased that there are voices emerging in the church who are making the very valid point that our reaction to our terrible past, our terrible history, must be moved beyond guilt. We will never get to reconciliation if we are mired in guilt. And I will confess that there are days, there have been days, when I have stood in circles as a representative of the church and I've been overwhelmed with guilt. But today, I believe we need to move forward. Because I believe the good news. I believe the gospel. I believe that the life was the light of all people, and that the light shines in darkness, and darkness never overcomes it. I was recently in Germany, and I had a wonderful discussion with my friend and former neighbor, Tom Geratz. Tom was 3 years old when I left Germany, and he was my friend. And now he's 14. And Tom has a very special field trip coming up this summer. He's going to be boarding a bus, and then he's going to travel for 18 hours from where he lives in Germany to Poland, to Auschwitz. And then 26 hours later, he's going to get back on the bus and travel back to his home. Why 26 hours? Well, Tom is repeating the journey of Anita Lichtenstein, a young German Jew who grew up in the community where Tom now lives, a young girl after which his school is named, a young girl who spent exactly 26 hours in Auschwitz before she was killed. There is no denying Germany's past, but this is an experience they are giving their children so they can make better decisions for their future. I end this morning with a question. What kind of experience can we give Canadians that we can reconcile with our past in order to make a more prosperous future together as people? May it be so, Lord. Amen.